interesting quotes in history and in our world today and slice right through them to reveal their origins, significance, and the people responsible for their being. Welcome back to the show. So in case you missed it, I recommend that you do listen to part one of this two-part series focusing on the case of the state of California versus the Menendez brothers. So in the previous episode of Honey with a Knife, we took a look at the background of the story such that we could understand where these two boys were coming from. These two boys who happened to be the same boys that murdered their parents in a Beverly Hills style mansion in August 20th of 1989. So after that, we did take a look at the parents' early life as well as the boys' early life, their character development. And then we looked at one specific night, which is the night of August 20th, 1989. We focused on the time period between 10 p.m. and 11:45 when this phone call came into the 911 dispatch.
Emergency?
Yes, police.
What's the problem? What's the problem?
Someone killed my parents.
Considering the identity of Honey with a Knife, I do tend to take a deeper look at quotes or something that has a quote-like aspect, which is exactly what I want to do with this 911 phone call. However, I am getting quite a number of questions from people who think that I should go into depth of this case or I should explore it more. And as much as I would love to do that, the main case of my podcast is not exactly crime or true crime. However, if you are interested in that, I have a new blog that I'm putting up soon. Be sure to check it out as soon as it's released. It will have the full story. It will have interviews with specific people related to the case and several more. Yes. So briefly about this episode before we get into it. In this episode, I'm simply going to be discussing what happened after the 911 phone call. And then I'm going to be looking a bit from a moral perspective. Why are we still able to trust dishonest people, especially as Generation Z that is coming up to support dishonest people? Why are we so able to easily look past the fact that they're dishonest and just trust them? Yes, so that is what we're going to be talking about today. Hopefully you enjoy this episode. Now, one important factor that you have to note when going into a courtroom for any case, whatever degree or whatever it is credibility. Credibility is one of the things that will determine whether you are found guilty or innocent. Not directly, but in a sense. So the definition of credibility, there are actually two definitions. Credibility is the quality of being trusted and believed in, or credibility is the quality of being convincing or believable. So it's simply trustworthiness or reliability. Now, one thing that the Menendez brothers did not have in their favor was their credibility. Where did that credibility disappear to? A 911 phone call. When they made that 911 phone call and said, someone killed my parents, they were lying, which we all know now. But at the time, the authorities did not know that, and it cast this shadow of innocence over the Menendez brothers. They were victims, they were hurt, and they were screaming and crying, and it really made sense at the time. But now that they're in a court case with all the evidence pointing against them, they have such low credibility, and the judge finds it so hard to believe anything that the boys are saying. So the boy's lawyer, who was specifically Eric's lawyer, was Leslie Abramson, and she decided to focus on the why of the case and not who, because everybody already knew that the boys did kill their parents. So instead of trying to pretend that it had not happened and it was not true, she decided to focus on why they killed their parents. She thought that if she could bring out the fact that the boys were sexually harassed, or that they were physically harassed, or they were in fear, they were trying to defend themselves, then maybe they would walk out of court as free men. But fear was quickly ruled out by the prosecution, because they began to describe that night what was on the coffee table. If you remember clearly, Kitty and Jose were in their den, lounging, eating vanilla ice cream and strawberries. And now the prosecution, which is the opposite side, the antagonistic side that's trying to prosecute these Menendez brothers, brings up the fact that there was nothing scary on that coffee table. Let's listen to the things that were on that coffee table. One, there were papers from UCLA, because that's where Eric was going in the summer. There were papers from UCLA. Two, there were drink glasses with vanilla ice cream. Vanilla ice cream, drink glasses, not scary yet. Three, there was a Michael Jackson cassette on the coffee table. Nothing scary so far. And four, there was a cigarette lighter. So, the prosecution brings up the fact that none of these things were scary enough to make the boys react out of the blue and kill their parents. The prosecution is trying to show that these boys premeditated the murder, that they had some thought to kill their parents. They didn't just do it out of self-defense. And this showed that the defendant's fear was fabricated. The people trying to say, oh, the Menendez brothers were innocent, their fear was fabricated. It was not true. Now, the boy's lying streak had gone from someone killed my parents, to I found a few items on a coffee table that were frightening enough to murder my parents. Now, even though the boys did have proof, some very, very minimal proof of sexual harassment, it was not enough for the judge to do anything, because it was very minimal and very sketchy, and it seemed almost as if it was not true. Even though they called several family members up and they testified that Jose was very abusive and a very angry person, the judge still found it hard to make a decision because of their credibility. By the time they lied on that 911 phone call, they did not think of any consequences. But now everyone finds it so hard to believe anything that these boys say because of the 911 phone call and the lies that they told. Now, in the midst of all this, Leslie Abramson tries to sort of erase the 911 phone call by focusing the lens on something else. The defense states that Kitty had a drinking problem and Jose was unfaithful to his wife, which obviously paints a picture of a dysfunctional home. Now, this could have worked. It could have worked. And in fact, it was on its way to working, because the defense even brought up expert psychologists to look at how these cues or this situation having abusive parents or parents that abused substances or alcohol, how it would have affected the boys. And these psychologists, yes, they do. They do tell the science very clearly. Scientists do not lie most of the time. So these scientists do go up and tell the courtroom that, yes, people who do grow up in abusive or dysfunctional homes tend to be wired differently to different cues. And so it could be possible that the boys simply, this was just an aftermath of several years of abuse. So that's one thing that psychologists testified in court that day when they were called to the stand. Now, at this point, they're still trying to decide what's happening. They're still trying to decide whether or not the boys are guilty or innocent. And at this point, the judge has decided that these boys are not going to walk out of court alone. They can get one of four charges. Now, all of them have to do with manslaughter. All of them have, but the only difference is just the degree. Was it premeditated? Was it not premeditated? Was it out of self-defense? And that's basically it. So these boys are not going to walk out of jail alone. I mean, they're not going to walk out of court free men. No, they had to be charged with something. And then a bombshell drops. It turns out, if you remember in the previous episode, I told you to mark the name of a family psychologist. Now, remember that family psychologist, Dr. L. Jerome Ozeal? It turns out that Dr. Ozil had set up an elaborate scheme a few days after this murder had happened, when he knew Eric was coming in for a therapy session. So he set up a bit of recording devices in his office, as well as calling his girlfriend to come and stand by the door in case anything happened while they were talking. And so Eric shows up to Ozil's office that day, and yes, Ozil is able to get Eric to confess. But it doesn't sound like Ozil is making Eric confess. It really just sounds like this is Eric's therapist and Eric is dealing with a lot, and so he decides to open up. That's what it sounds like. So yes, the confession is taken on tape, and then Ozil tells Eric to call Lyle into the office. And so Eric calls Lyle. Lyle has no idea why Eric has called him, but he makes his way to Dr. Jerome Ozil's office. And when Lyle gets there and sees that Eric has confessed to the crime, he's very angry because he's like, we should have gotten away with this, and now there's a chance that we will not. So he was very, very angry. Lyle was impulsive. He was very angry, and he threatened to kill Dr. Ozil. That threatening would be used against him in court. Now, when Ozil was called to the stand by the prosecution to testify that he had actually a recording of confession on tape, it was rejected by Eric's lawyers and Lyle's lawyers because they said that there had to be patient-therapist privilege. Now, after weeks and weeks and weeks of battling it out with whether these tapes should have been played in court, the prosecution decided to use the fact that Lyle had threatened Dr. Ozil to bring up the fact that patient-therapist privilege did not apply here anymore. Ozil decided to tell the court that the motive for these boys killing their parents was hatred. But it was also hard to believe Ozil. His credibility was also super low because they wanted to know why he was recording that session in the first place. They wanted to know why he had several recordings of the boys' therapy sessions. Was he going to try to use these recordings against the boys for any reason? Because Ozil had these recordings, but he did not turn them in immediately. In fact, his girlfriend later is the one that revealed to the police and the authorities that Ozil had these confession tapes. So they wanted to know if Ozil had a motive for money. Money. Now that's where it comes in. Money for murder. Now, remember that friend script that Eric co-wrote with his friend Craig Carnelli? That script, and no, not that friend. No one told you that was gonna be this way. That script gave the judge even more reason to believe that the boys had a motive to murder their parent. So since the boys' credibility was so damaged, it was extremely hard for the juries to come to a conclusion because they weren't sure what information to believe or what information was valid and what was not. Now, at the start, two separate juries were appointed for this case, one for Eric and one for Lyle, and each of those juries had 12 jurors. And after 5 months in and out, battling it out in court, the jurors were given time to make their decisions. Now, more than 3 weeks went by and the jurors couldn't seem to come to a single decision. After 19 days, Eric's jury returns deadlocked. They have no decision whatsoever, and the court declares a mistrial. And then 15 days after that, Lyle's jury comes back with the same result. They come back deadlocked as well. Now, 4 years pass and no verdict has been made over the case of the state of California versus the Menendez brothers. Now, Eric and Lyle will be tried a second time at this time, and new prosecutors will be appointed. Now, in the second trial, there were no cameras allowed in the courtroom, and the jurors who were present that day say that Eric wasn't even allowed to testify about the abuse. It was focused on Lyle's testimony alone, and that is what the judge used to determine it. And I really don't blame him, because at this point, The case was so nationwide known that everyone was interested in it, and it was putting so much pressure on the jurors to determine if the boys were telling the truth or if the boys were saying things that were valid. But it was so hard to believe them, and you really cannot blame anyone for not believing them. And at this point, there were no cameras in the court in the second trial. And the brothers were sentenced to life in prison with no chance for parole, which means there was absolutely no chance that they would be reviewed later or set free later on. And then came TikTok. TikTok can do a lot of things, from finding people's weird lost crushes at the airport or making someone that acted out something become an actual Hollywood actor, or making a song that once went viral into a popular hit. TikTok can literally do anything. And thousands of TikTok accounts have actually been created in defense of the Menendez brothers, and they're calling themselves the Menendez supporters, which is a movement of Generation Z. Now, this really should not be underestimated. It may sound like a cool hashtag, but it really should not be underestimated. Even though at first it started as a joke when people were just singing, "Oh mama, I'm in love with a criminal." It started as a joke and people were just posting videos about it. And then later on, it became more serious when people started to look at the court case and realize that maybe these two brothers were not given justice after all, simply because of the time that they were living in. And now Generation Z has taken it upon themselves to come up and support these two brothers and file that these brothers must be released from jail because they are innocent. Now, I just find it so hard to believe that Generation Z would do this, but at this point, nothing is out of their list of what they can do, so we really should not be surprised. But one thing that is definitely still surprising regardless is how we are so able to support dishonest people. Now, I'm not saying that the Menendez brothers had no reason to murder their parents, because I think we're all a bit confused on where to stand in this case. But I do think that they were very dishonest. They had such low credibility. They told so many lies in court that it was very hard to believe them. And yet we're still able to stand up and support them. So now my question is, why are we able to support such dishonest people? Now, due to the pushing of the Menendez supporters and the presentation of new evidence this year, I feel like I should mention that the case may be reopened for trial, which is a very big deal. 47 years, this case will be open for retrial. It's likely that it will be open for retrial simply because of the Generation Z movement, the Menendez supporters, and new evidence that was found because of the Menendez supporters. It's amazing how an entire generation would choose to believe two brothers who already proved their dishonesty. And it's not an entire generation, because of course there are people that stand on the opposite side and say, no, this isn't true, no, the brothers deserve to go to jail. And then the people in the same generation that say, no, they're innocent, they were victims of abuse, not killers. So it's all wide round. But I think I found the answer to the question, why are we so able to support dishonest people even after 911 phone calls like that one? I found the answer while I was scrolling through TikTok, scrolling through a TikTok comment section specifically. So I found a TikTok that was talking about the Menendez brothers and the Menendez supporters and how the case was going to be reopened. And then in the comments, you could see things like, yes, this is all the power that Generation Z holds, and they have no idea how much power we hold. I'm so glad to be in this generation because it makes me feel powerful, and so many other things. And I noticed a theme. I noticed power. I think power can influence the way we choose to think about situations. Power can influence the way we view people, in fact, how much power they give us, whether that's emotional power or physical power. As long as they give us power over something, it can influence our perspective on them. And a friend of mine likes to say, power corrupts. Now, I guess that depends on whose side you are on. Do you stand with the Menendez brothers or against them? So if you'd like to hear more about that case, do let me know. But it will be specifically on my blog and not on the podcast. So stay tuned for more interesting episodes. I guarantee there are several ideas that I have that I hope I will be able to have you listen to. So thank you so much for joining me on this hopefully intriguing journey, and join me next time as I take a deeper look into the most fascinating quotes and quote-like things in our world today, only here on Honey with a Knife.
You've been listening to Honey with a Knife, a podcast of VIV.